Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisoners in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they get their hands on to incarcerate. And that's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, boy, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
By now, you're all excited to run out there.
So you want to be a player, but your wheels ain't fly. You got to hit us up to get a pimped out ride.
You got to pimp my ride.
Damn right.
I used to spend the night in hotel parking lots. What was I going to do? I ain't had nowhere to stay, so I lived in the car. I had $35. And I said, come on, God, man, I've been trying to make this dream come true. You done left me out here like this. And I was crying so hard that he just said, I didn't like hear a voice or nothing, but he spoke to me. And however, he said, if you get up, I'm going to take you places you ain't never been. Now, I was finna quit. So I said, skip it. I'm going to quit anyway. So I got in my car. I went to a payphone. And I was going to call my dad. You remember back in the day where you could punch in a code and call your answering machine and get your messages? So I called and I punched in the code and the dude said, doop. He said, hey, Steve, this is Chuck Sutton with Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of you. You're very funny. If you could get here Sunday night, we'd love to put you on television. Call me back. Let me know if you can make it. So I hung the phone up. I'm crushed because my whole dream of being on TV, and I couldn't get to New York. I got $35. How am I going to get to New York? I can't make it. So I'm standing there at the phone booth and tears just coming down my face. I said, God, so that must be a sign for me to go home. Because this it, I ain't even got the money to go to the Apollo. My whole thing, wanting to be on TV, I couldn't even make the dream come true. This is the most messed up moment. And so I said, man, let me call this dude back and see if he said this Sunday. Because maybe he said next Sunday and I could hustle up a little bit of money or something. I don't know what I'm going to do, but let me just call him back. So I call him back. Steve, this is Chuck Sutton, Showtime at the Apollo. We saw a tape of yours. You're very, very funny. Look, we have an opening Sunday night at Showtime at the Apollo. If you can make it, we'd love to put you on TV. I said, it's this Sunday. Before I hit the button, I heard, doop, you have another message. Now, it wasn't there before. So I punched my code in. I listened to the second message. It said, Steve Harvey, this is Tom Sober from the Comedy Caravan. This was a Thursday. He said, I have a gig in Jacksonville, Florida on Friday night that pays $150. If you can get there Friday night, you'll make $150. So I called him back and I said, hey, Tom, did you get a gig away? He said, no, it's still available. He said, can you get there? I said, I'm in Pensacola, Florida. I'm 3.5 hours away. So I drive to Jacksonville, Florida, and that night I made the 150. The club owner said, man, you're funnier than the guy we hired. If you stay tomorrow night, I'm going to give you another $150. So now I got $300 now. So I get on the phone. I call Chuck Sutton. I say, hey, man, is the gig still available at Showtime at the Apollo? He said, yeah, we got one opening left. I said, I'll be there. So I call Eastern Airlines, who used to be open back then. They had a special for $99 going from Jacksonville, Florida to New York round trip. So I parked my car at the airport. I got it. Got on plane, flew. Everything I had was in two bags. Got to the Apollo. I said, hey, man, I'm here. I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning. He said, you can't stay here because you don't come on to the late show tonight. I said, man, I ain't got nowhere to go. I said, if you just let me stay in this building, man, I ain't going to move around nothing. I ain't got nowhere to go. I'm in Harlem. I can't go back out here. I got these two bags. I got victim wrote all over me, man. So he said, all right, if you go upstairs, don't come down. So he put me in a dressing room on the sixth floor. So that's where all the comedians were. So I stayed up there. I got hungry around 3 o'clock, man. I couldn't take it no more. So I went back downstairs, a dude named Alton Liston. I said, hey, man. He said, man, I thought I told you, don't come down them damn steps. I said, hey, man, I'm just hungry, man. I said, let me go to that KFC I saw in the corner. Just let me get some chicken. I'll come right back. He said, man, if you ain't back in 20 minutes, you ain't getting in this building. So I went, bought me some chicken, came back. So the comedians started coming in the building. They started coming up on the sixth floor. So I meet this guy named D.L. Hughley. I introduce myself. He introduced himself. I'm sitting there. Another guy come in named Dwayne Johnson. Then this other dude walked in named Jamie Foxx. And I introduced myself. We don't know each other. Ain't none of us famous. It's 1991, man. They gave everybody the lineup. I was on the last show of the night. I don't go on to 11 at night. I'd have had this 4 pieces of chicken. I'm starving, man. That chicken done wore off. I'm nervous, man. I'm about to throw up. D.L. Hughley went downstairs. D.L. Hughley got booed off. Dwayne Johnson got booed off. Jamie Foxx went down there and got booed. They booed Jamie, then Jamie started singing. And then they started clapping. And Jamie had their ass Then he went back to them jokes, and they got his ass. So I'm walking down the steps, and I see Jamie sitting on the steps. I said, hey, man, hang in there. He said, man, that ain't never happened to me before, man. This is crazy. This is Jamie Foxx, man, one of the most talented people in all of comedy. And now, you don't even know how nervous I am, man. I can't even. My breathing is shot because these dudes been booed. So I walk out. I had wrote this joke. Mike Tyson had got in a fight in Harlem with this heavyweight named Mitch Green. Mike Tyson had hit the dude in the eye in the store. Now, he was on the news. His eye was swollen. So the joke I wrote was they was interviewing Mitch Green, and he was telling everybody what happened, but his eye took over the interview. And I wrote this joke that his eye started talking and was just, I tell you what happened. The heavyweight champ's fist is coming towards my face. I just said, Lord, Lord, Lord. And I wrote this whole joke about this dude's eyeball talking. And when the punch came, and all this here, the Apollo, man, they went crazy. They lost their mind. I got a standing ovation, man. I walked off stage, man, just started crying. I couldn't believe it. And they paid me. I made $750 for being on TV for one night. I had never made $750 telling jokes in one night. And so that was my first television appearance. A couple weeks later, Sinbad was the host of the show. He got this job Different World. And so he quit. And so Mark Curry became the host. And then Mark Curry got hanging with Mr. Cooper, and he quit. And they came to me and said, would you come back to New York and host Amateur Night for us to just try you out? Oh, ain't no problem. And so I went to New York. I hosted Amateur Night, and I was killing. But every time we went to commercial break, I was supposed to let the warm-up act take over like Ruben does. But I knew not to let the warm-up act do that because he would change the attitude of the crowd because the Apollo was a wild place. So I stayed out there. I did the warm-up and the hosting. And I created a bond with that audience. And that's how I got on TV. It was my very first TV show. I hosted Showtime at the Apollo. I ended up being the longest-running host in the history of Showtime. I did that show for 8 years. Nobody ever did it for 8 years. And that was my turn back moment. See, in your life, everybody has a turn back moment. You have a moment where you can go forward or you can give up. But the thing you have to keep in mind before you give up is that if you give up, the guarantee is it will never happen. That's the guarantee of quitting, that it will never happen, no way under the sun. The only way the possibility remains that it can happen is if you never give up no matter what. Because God is always coming. He's never too late. At your worst moment, look, man, when they told me I had to be in New York, I saw no way I could get there. But that God, though, he make the phone ring. I end up in Florida. I make $300. Then I go to New York, I make $750. Almost got $1,000 out of nowhere. That's what happened to me. That was my moment of never giving up. That's when I first learned that faith was everything, that you have to remain faithful. Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. He messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the dough. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the dough? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what to happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarion. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarion took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarion, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarion Styles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarion can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Well, I was born in Brownsville in the 50s, and I lived on 45th and Forestville, which is a little short block, which is a great residential neighborhood. After the restrictive covenant was lifted, we moved to Chatham, and I grew up in Chatham, and then went away to college, came back, lived in Hyde Park. Raised my kids in Hyde Park, and when they were grown, quickly zipped it back to Brownsville.
Really? What prompted your move right back to Brownsville?
Well, it was really in my soul. I mean, I remember as a kid with my daddy walking. We didn't have a car. You know, it was like 1952, 53, 54. And we didn't have a car, so we walked the neighborhood, and I remember walking the neighborhood. And one of my favorite memories is going out on Halloween and with Daddy, and we would go to the stores on 47th Street, and they didn't give you candy, they gave you pennies. You might have an apple and a whole bag of pennies. And I just remember that. So it just stuck with me. My father's family lived in Brownsville. They owned homes in Brownsville in the 50s. So it's just something that's hard to explain, but it's in my soul. I really believe in diverse community. So my mantra has been, I've always lived in diverse communities. I look at Hyde Park, having spent, you know, 20 years in Hyde Park, as sort of a model of how communities can work and how residents can own their community, control what goes on in their community. So I think that's something that we really want to be able to do. I want us to keep our African-American heritage as we are diverse. So once again, my mantra has been, I want to have a diverse community. I just don't want to be the minority this time. Change the culture and the individuality as an African-American community. And And to do all of that, you got to have economic development. I mean, you got to have jobs. You got to have. I mean, I am a founder of the Brownsville Retail Initiative, and our goal is to create walkable retail corridors in Brownsville. I mean, you know, your whole sense of community happens up and down those streets, 7th Street, you know, in the past, 43rd Street in the past, and to try to figure out what the new commercial strip looks like. Commercial strips define communities. I mean, you can, if you think about driving through communities, you drive down commercial strips. Now, you can have great housing, great residential, but if you don't, you know, the only thing that gets you out of the car unless you're going to a destination is somebody's house, it's a commercial strip. And so you sort of look at the commercial strip and see what, so you know, you see what Andersonville is. You know, how many people are driving down the side streets, everybody's on Clark Street or whatever it's like. Ah, this is a great place to be. So that's very important to the economic development of the community. Part of my concern is that we maintain the flavor of the community. I think it's a challenge because the price points are a lot higher, you know, but people's salaries haven't zipped up with the price points. If we could have a diverse, thriving community with a African-American historical base, cultural historical base, with good schools, lots of arts and culture, good economic development, it can be like your Hyde Park, but it would demonstrate that it doesn't have to be University of Chicago based. It doesn't have to be white based. It can be minority based. And African-American in particular, because we have particular perception issues, you know? So if that could happen, just imagine if that could happen. That's why I talk about the promise of Brownsville. The promise of Brownsville is bigger than what it is to be here. It also projects what could be. I mean, I know how the cycles work, you know, and how the gentrification works, but it doesn't have to be that. So, I mean, if we could be a model for what a diversified African-American cultural-based community can be, and that would be great for the city. Okay?
Cool. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
A big part of the work while I was at the Arts Alliance is to get artists and creatives to lean in and to get more actively involved in public life and to really flex their activism muscles and to give voice to public policies that support the arts in people's lives, schools, and communities. I am a big believer that there's a strong connection between artistry and citizenry. That creating and sharing art is one of the most powerful ways to strengthen our democracy and promote vibrant communities. And the work that I'm in now is really around political reform and public policy and how we can change the rules that govern political participation to make them more fair and functional and inclusive. Also, a big part of the work that I'm involved in now is getting more people, average people, to tune in and get actively involved in civic life, to climb the ladder of civic engagement. I am a proud Chicagoan and resident of Brownsville. I've been in the neighborhood since the early 2000s. What attracted me to the neighborhood is the rich history that exists in Brownsville. It's a mecca for black creativity and entrepreneurship and ingenuity. You know, we have these stately boulevards. We have just the architectural artistry of the homes, these handsome, muscular, beautiful gray stones and brownstones. And then the people, you know, the artists and intellectuals and businessmen and women that call Bronzeville home is stunning. I think you'd be hard pressed to find any other neighborhood in the world that has as rich history and legacy as Bronzeville does. I live in a home that was owned by a legendary jazz man named Sonny Stitt. I live right next door to the home of Dr. Daniel Hale Williams, who performed the world's first successful open heart surgery. I live around the corner from the home of Louis Armstrong. Bronzeville has such a textured history of creativity, and that's one of the many reasons why I'm proud to call Bronzeville home. I think there's a really powerful connection between the arts and creative expression and the Bronzeville community. I think one of the things that I really appreciate about the neighborhood is the public art. 2017 is the year of public art for Chicago. Bronzeville is home to some of the world's most famous public art installations. And I think about the Wall of Respect and the impact that that had here in Chicago and around the world. I think there's a really strong connection between the arts and community building. When you think about how you build and foster a sense of community and connection, you do that by getting people up off of their couches, away from their TV screens and their iPads and their iPhones. You bring them together for shared experience. You create opportunities for people to look each other in the eye. You create openings where people can interact, and that's something that the arts, it provides that platform. And there's such a rich history in Bronzeville around the role of culture and the role of culture in creating an identity for a community and bringing people together that it's exciting to think about the future for Bronzeville. And it's one that I think will be powered by community development and cultural preservation and really elevating the role of the arts to help tell the story of Bronzeville. I think it's also a place that fosters civic pride. And that's something that's so important for our city. Is a sense of connection and pride. And we joked earlier about the Cubs, but how flying the W puts us in a happier space. Right? It allows us to really, just for a moment, move beyond the negative narratives that exist around our city. Foster civic pride by lifting up are often untold, undertold stories. And that's the really exciting part about a better Bronzeville, that we have so many wonderful stories to tell.
With Bronzeville, I grew up in the neighborhood, grandfather was in the neighborhood, went to school in the neighborhood. And then I have a very personal history with the neighborhood, whereas my ancestors were part of the community. My great-great-grandfather, Anthony Overton, was the first black business mogul. He had multiple enterprises in the neighborhood, which employed folks and provided goods and services to folks, included in which was the second nationally chartered black bank. He had the Anthony Overton High Brown Overton Cosmetics. So he was the first person to provide cosmetics for women of color. He had an insurance company. He had a newspaper, and then other, smaller assets in the community, which facilitated the community. Yeah. I think that what we are is kind of on the uptrend of a cycle of trying to bring Brownsville back for what it once was. It was once, the Black Belt. This is where African Americans were confined in this city. Once had six times the current population, I think it was. It seems even in the conversations that I have had with folks since sort of its demise, every generation has participated in an effort to try and bring Brownsville back. Brownsville is, like many places in this country, relevant, very relevant to the cultural implications and the history of many communities. Brownsville was home to artists and business folks. It produced people who were educated. It produced and housed, the working class. It was very diverse, and it is an important part of our history and our cultural experience as Black Americans from the Midwest and from Chicago. And so those types of relationships, be it economic and cultural, I think were vital, and because they were vital, they continue to be vital. They continue to be a part of the DNA of our cultural experience. We acknowledging that, strengthening that, highlighting that, I think above all else will have cultural and social implications for folks in my generation who have no idea that this place existed and what it meant. It becomes a conversation of, well, you can be not, Obama shows that you can be black and be the president, but it shows that you can be black and you can be a successful business owner. You can be a successful doctor. You can be a successful whatever, because this community existed, but it has essentially been washed from history.
What do you envision for the future of Brownsville?
As a millennial, we're a new type of hippies. we have hearts that bleed a lot. I envision a community that is in line and consistent with a larger vision for the world, which is one where unity actually exists, and it doesn't find itself limited by not just the superficial things, but even the deeper things, whether those deeper things are larger religious and cultural and social differences, vehement differences, but that we find that our larger unity is woven through our willingness and our desire to just have love for one another. And so I see a space where people are not biased or stereotyped by outsiders or insiders. I see a space where all dreams, as cliche as that is, can be actualized on some level. But I think that this is a vision that is in line with a global vision that a lot of people in my age group have. I hope we will one day see. To be frank with you, people just from that community, it's
you turn this story of success, humble beginnings to, you know, commercial success, your products are everywhere, into the story of Miss Jessie's, which is now a best-selling book. Talk to me about the process of writing, because while you were going through this book, you also experienced tragedy and losing your sister, Kiti. How did you face that tragedy, and what made you keep going to write the book?
Well, the wonderful news is before my sister passed away, she and I had a conversation, and the conversation was actually led by Titi. And Titi thought that now is a time for us to share our story. And the reason why she thought it was important to share our story is because although we became successful in making curly pudding and we were also very successful in our business, I think the number one question we were getting all the time is, how did you do it? How did you create this business from scratch? You know, during a time when, you know, we can be very helpful because there's a lot of information sharing, this is a time where we wanted to tell you how we did it. So how did we do it? We had a wonderful partnership. We had love. We had sisterhood. We tapped into our strengths, which were God-given. I was always a great stylist. Titi was always a great organizer, a great communicator, but she was also a great big sister. So that trust and that, that just that togetherness that we had really served us well in business. And what we did was we built slowly but surely because we didn't have loans, because we didn't have angel investors. We found ourselves, we made a little bit of money, and we saved half. Saving half was a little bit challenging because we were in our early 20s. So being a young lady in New York in the 90s, I mean, it was kind of hard not to go to the party.
You could spend that money easily.
You could buy a bag. I mean, you could buy, you know, you can spend your money in so many different ways as a young adult. But what we did was we didn't go to the party. We reinvested in our business, and slowly but surely, we had a little chunk of money, and we kept doing that till finally we, you know, we were able to make a wonderful product. And then eventually Target called us, and the rest is history.
That's great. Yeah. But there were also some challenges along the way, too, right? You talked at one point about the IRS coming in. And even though you'd saved all this money, the IRS still wanted a little extra payback. How did you deal with that challenge?
Well, first of all, we had to realize that we had a third partner. For a little bit, we thought that it was just she and I that were in business.
Right. No, Uncle Sam is always in the mix.
Yeah. So when we experienced some level of success, which we did, you know, we had to cut a portion off, and we had to break the IRS off some. And we thought that, oh, wow, are we going to have to continue doing this? And the answer was yes. So one way we could offset that was by purchasing a house. And that house ended up being, you know, the Miss Jessie's headquarters. Thank God we bought it. But, you know, there's so many different lessons as an entrepreneur that you're going to learn. You don't learn everything in a classroom. You don't always have that mentor on hand. And being able to tap into all the lessons or even all the failures are going to serve you well, because many of us don't want to relearn the same lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So Titi and I had to really understand that these lessons are going to help us, and there would be no Miss Jessie's had we not failed in the early days.
Absolutely. For people who never got a chance to meet your sister, what are some of your favorite memories just about who she was, both as a sister to you but also a businesswoman? Because when you look at this book, you know, she's the other half of it.
Yeah, Titi was so phenomenal as a woman, as a sister, as a co-parent, as a roommate, as a friend. But she was also a very good businesswoman. And I don't think I've met another human being yet that encompassed so many things in one body. And she was not only all those wonderful things, she was also aesthetically and physically beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And many people, when my sister passed away on December 4th, 2014, it was so puzzling to people that my sister passed away, and her passing was reported as a suicide. And it was puzzling to people because she had just so many things, you know. I mean, I know many women who just want beauty. I know many women who just want to have a successful business, and for her to have all those things was kind of, many people didn't understand how Titi is no longer with us. But, you know, as her sister and as a person who witnessed her battle with depression, I definitely want to share that it's real and it can happen to anyone. It's actually an illness. and it was actually something, Titi's dilemma and Titi's challenges with mental illness and depression was really something that she was battling alone. Our family was very ignorant to the illness, and in hindsight, I wish we could have been more helpful to her. But I do believe that Titi's death was not in vain, because you and I are having this conversation, and I've witnessed just wonderful conversations that I've had, you know, in the name of Titi. And I believe that Titi's presence on this planet was a wonderful one. Her contribution to this world was so great, particularly to women. And not only was she a great contributor to women in their self-esteem and their curls and their hair, I think we can also look at Titi and learn a lot from her story just in her battle with depression. So Titi is still contributing in a wonderful way, and her legacy so, so important. And this is a wonderful way, our book is a wonderful way for me to keep sharing about this wonderful woman, Titi Branch.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. It is, and it does open a conversation that we all need to have, and that maybe we can save, you know, other lives just by being able to talk about these issues, because everyone can be affected. It's true.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think the love and support is probably the most important thing, because many of us are not, we're not physicians, and sometimes we don't have the right answers, but I think just that love is going to be very, very helpful.
I called because I heard you went and visited Donnett.
No.
Told him my son's death couldn't have been no suicide. Is that right?
I did do that.
D'Angelo hung himself.
Not with the belt they found around his neck. Not at that distance between the doorknob and the floor.
So what are you saying?
What am I saying?
No. Nobody would have dared. My brother, his uncle, would have...
I agree with you. Nobody would have dared. Unless...
Avon and Dee was family.
Family, right.
This is just you talking, right? I mean, anyone else saying it?
No, just me. No one else cares.
Right.
It's just, I don't know, on the inside. Somebody's going after you. He's got a beef. Sees red. They use a shank. It's quick, and it's over. D'Angelo was strangled, which is planned. You need the time. You need the isolation. Look, I'm just sorry I brought this whole mess up to begin with, because frankly, no one's going to do shit about it anyhow. Whoever killed him wanted to pass it off as a suicide, and the cops are happy enough to have one less murder to investigate. On top of that, the Anne Arundel state's attorney doesn't give a fuck. I'm not supposed to give a fuck, so... guess your son just got squeezed between the sides.
Squeezed between what sides?
Look, 2 years ago, we hung more wire on your brother's crew than AT&T. And at the end, D'Angelo was this close to flipping, giving up everybody, everything. You know all that, right? You were the one who went down that detention center and talked your son out of a deal. I kind of liked your son, you know. All things considered, he was a pretty decent kid. And it grinds me that no one ever spoke up for him. Seems to me that nobody ever will. But mostly at this point, I'm sorry I bothered his girl. And I'm sorry she bothered you.
Why go to her? Why not come to me first?
Honestly? I was looking for somebody who cared about the kid. I mean, like I said, you were the one who made him take the years, right?
They got you all the way out here, huh? Started out thinking you was in Jersey. You ain't in Jersey. I figure they still got you down in Central Booking. All the way out here. You send a message, though.
Yeah, well, a message needs sending. How y'all even find me?
Ain't no one gonna keep a mother from her son, man. Right?
You know, he always talking family. Family is the heart, he say. Well, I'm family, ain't I? Well, what about me for once? It ain't right.
What's right? You like him to step up? Take all the weight and let you walk? Because he will. You know he will. But if he got to go away, that means you got to step up and fill his shoes. You ready for that?
Ma, you know I ain't. I ain't ready, and I ain't never going to be ready for this game.
D, come on.
Look, they giving me a chance to walk away, to start again someplace else.
And what you giving them? He messed up, Dave. He knows it. Now, if you want to get even with him, you can. But you hurt him, you hurt this whole family. All of us. Me and Trina and the cousins. And Donette, too. And your baby. Your own baby boy. This right here is part of the game, Dee. And without the game, this whole family would be down in the fucking terrace living off scraps. Shit, we probably wouldn't even be a family. Start over, huh? How the fuck you gonna start over without your peoples? Without your own child, even? You ain't got family in this world. What the hell you got?
Okay, put the asshole on.
This is he.
Where's the rice-a-roni? Ma, where's the rice-a-roni?
Erickson's boy in the stoop looked like he was starving.
So you cooked it for him?
Nah, I just gave it to him.
Just gave it to him? Boy ate a raw box of rice-a-roni. How much did you sell the groceries for?
Don't look at me like that. I gotta go out.
You have your rights, Roni profit.
Michael, come on. Boy, I ain't gonna let you hold the DSS card if you ain't gonna do right by me.
You gonna let me hold that card?
You a hard child.
Next time, don't go selling the food out of our mouths. Where am I at?
Upstairs. Michael, my daddy came home.
Daddy came?
Look who home.
Michael. Damn, you grew.
no, you not. What's this shit doing in my house?
I'm stretching bottles, Ma.
You ever see your daddy bring his work home with him like that? That's what you got a lieutenant for. Police come through this door instead of your mother. They would have this whole damn house. It's all got to be packed up and elsewhere right now.
All right, be cool.
Wait till they hear about this.
All right, that was a couple of two, three scenes from the television program The Wire. If you have not watched it, go to Amazon or maybe even YouTube. You can rent it or buy it. I don't know, maybe somebody's got a bootleg copy that they've uploaded to YouTube. I think it's 5 seasons of it. Be a pretty good binge watch on what's happening in various parts of urban America. That took place, The Wire took place, takes place rather in Baltimore City. Now, before that, now that's TV, but we had a clip on Bronzeville. And for those of you who are not familiar with Bronzeville, let me go to the phone lines here. Let's see. Bronzeville. And we're going to Wikipedia. And see what they have to say. Wait a minute. Here we go. Now, this is just the... okay, Bronzeville. They have it as a neighborhood in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, as well as Chicago. But we're going with Illinois version. Bronzeville is an area comprising the Douglas, Grandview, and Oakland communities on the south side of Chicago around the Illinois Institute of Technology, Vandercook College of Music, and Illinois College of Optometry. It is accessible via the green and red lines of the Chicago Transit Authority, as well as the Meta Electric District Main Line. Let's see. In the early 20th century, Bronzeville was known as the Black Metropolis, one of the nation's significant concentrations of African-American businesses and culture. The groundbreaking Pekin Theater, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, Pekin Theater, rose near 27th Street on the first decade of the 20th century, between 1910 and 1920, during the early peak of the Great Migration. The population of the area increased dramatically when thousands of Black Americans escaped oppression of the South and migrated to Chicago in search of industrial jobs. The Wabash YMCA, now considered the first Black YMCA in the United States, it remains active today due to ongoing support from nearby Black churches. The Wabash YMCA's work commemorates Black culture with the genesis of Black History Month. In 1922, Louis B. Anderson, a Chicago alderman, had the architects Michelson and Rogenstock build him a house at 3800 South Calumet Avenue. Let's see, Andrew Rube Foster, founder of the Negro Baseball League, Ida B. Wells. These are some of the people that lived in Bronzeville. And Rube Foster, we need to do something special on him. Rube Foster, I'm now a Bronzeville resident at one time. September 17, 1879 to December 9th, 1930 was an American. This is one of the things I like about the Chicago area. Andrew Rube Foster, an American baseball player, manager, and executive in the Negro Leagues. He was elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1981. Let's see. Early years. All right. He started out in Texas. Okay. All right. Well, he was one of the key figures. All right. All right. They say he was founder of the Negro-based National Baseball League. That's what we need to do again, start on leagues. Ida B. Wells, she lived there. Margaret Taylor Burroughs, artist, author, she lived there. DuSable Museum of African American History. Bessie Coleman, the first black woman pilot. Gwendolyn Brooks. Let's see. And I think they've even made a movie about Bronzeville, or at least a documentary that involves, I think, Lawrence Fishburne, I think. All right, let's see. And Quincy Jones, he resided in Bronzeville for a bit at 3548 South Perry Avenue, R. Kelly, let's see, Ronnie Lester, Arthur Wirtz Mitchell, Lou Rawls. So you got quite a lineup of people that lived in the Bronzeville area. Now, what I want to know, now, was Bronzeville at any time an independent village or town that got annexed by Chicago? That part I do not know. There's even a play about Bronzeville that came over that was done in 2009 by Tim Tayoma and Aaron Wolfolk. Okay, anyway, seems like if you're up in the Chicago area, take some time out and visit Bronzeville. Okay, let's go to the phone lines here. I know they had a podcast. Larry Fishman, he was doing a podcast on Bronzeville some years ago. I'm sure it's online somewhere. I'm waiting for my phone to populate. You can say 2945. First Friday in the month of June 2023. 773, your mic is open.
Greetings, good rising. How are you?
Fine. Well, you know something about Bronzeville. Tell us, share with us what we don't know about Bronzeville.
You sure should learn about the late Honorable Robert Booth, my dad. He was a three-area tradesman. He helped a lot of seniors there to sustain and maintain their properties when they could not afford a general contractor.
Let's go with you. Reba, hold on, wait a minute. Where was your father originally from? Was he born in Chicago or Illinois or what?
He was born in Chicago, and then 35th in Indiana is the location of the property that my grandmother bought. I think she bought it for like $17,000 cash, paid for. And
now,
where was she from
originally?
I don't know. I do not know. I'm going to be honest with you. Do not know where my grandmother was from. So,
now what about your mother? Where was she from originally?
A lot of my family was from Meridian, Mississippi. Because we had like a settlement. We have the Booth settlement, which spans across like Meridian, Mississippi, and so forth. So my brother's son just let me know that he's
another name for settlement is you guys had your own village.
Yes. Yes. So we actually have we still have a cemetery, churches. I think there's one church still left down south. And my dad would tell us about the Boo settlement growing up. So it's pretty interesting how, you know, we just knew that we were, as we said, born into wealth. The establishment, like I said, led to a family cemetery, churches. Unfortunately, some of our land is being sold off by some family members. I don't know if it's to maintain.
You know
maybe
how many acres that was?
I don't know, but I can't give my cousin Susan, because mind you, I was not really connected with my father's side of family. He's now transitioned. But Susan, who was on the line, she and I were doing some research. Now, another cousin I want to reach out to is Ann Buffington. So she knows everything about the family. Pardon me?
It's on Facebook.
What do you mean?
Wait a minute. All right. The Booth family.
We do have a few pages.
In 1983. Yeah. Mississippi Booth settlement. And for people that don't know, the word settlement, that are like Chicago is a settlement, but it's incorporated. So a settlement is actually a village, or it's a village, or your own little town. So, that's impressive. So that sounds like 48, at least no less than 40 acres. But anyway, 19, the Booth settlement.
Because families actually did purchase more land. Unfortunately, some of it's being sold off. And I was just, encouraged that, it's not just to sell it off, but the people who are managing the property may have needed. And this is what I found out on Clubhouse. One of the young people, millennials on Clubhouse, said that it may not have been a selfish reason. It may have been to pay off current taxes on some of the property. But I still feel that, family members should reach out, because we have different Facebook groups. Information like that, I think should be shared, or at least, like I said, with Anne. She's my great cousin. She's my dad's cousin. And I certainly want to get her on. Her daughter's an attorney. Her other daughter, one of her daughters is an attorney. The other one's a teacher who has a book out. So my father's side of family is certainly has a rich, rich culture. I'm excited about learning more about Bronzeville, with what you shared the audio. So Devontae Johnson should be on listening in. He's a tax investor, so I don't know if he went into the host queue, but I did want to have – he said that he would be listening in.
Oh, all right. Well, I got to
– So.
Let me go.
I will bring my cousin back, Ambrose Buffington, to share, because she knows like great great grandfathers, and so we were Booth. Some people changed the name from within a Z with a S to a Z, and then we're connected to Henry Booth in some way. So we have a Henry Booth. I don't know if it was Henry Booth at one point, but this thing is putting a lot of pieces together. But it's exciting. We have a family crest. We have charters in just about almost every state in the nation. So, every year, it used to be a reunion in a different state every year. So until COVID, until shelter in place. So, and then they did a virtual. I didn't get wind of that until later, that there was a virtual reunion. So certainly we'll get Susan back on, and then Ann. And then we have a cousin who's a farmer, grows beautiful fruits and vegetables, so we'll get her on as well. I'm going to just text Susan and see if she's available. She's in New York.
Okay. I'm working on my phone.
again, Brownsville, that my grandmother had a property in Brownsville that although the building was demolished, I am fighting to legally reobtain that property that's next door to a church. So Brownsville's rich community had the Brownsville Visitors Information Center, and with all due respect for the late Honorable Harold Lucas, who founded the Brownsville Visitors Information Center, which shared the history of Brownsville and the Black Youth Metropolis, the Black Belt. So I will certainly look into seeing how those archives are being maintained, because when I visited, I was able to see some, you know, some vintage photos and so forth. And then I connected with a couple of youth, which is where the Black Youth Metropolis was birthed from, the idea of Mr. Harold Lucas connecting me with some youth that were actually on site. Like, they didn't have something, they didn't have anything to do after school, and so I was able to run into a few of them, and we did a project where we were hanging some of those vintage photos on the wall. So it was interesting. So mm-hmm. I will certainly do some homework and bring some people to the table to share more than what I know, because I just have a skeleton view of the history.
Okay, well, I'm impressed with what I heard, particularly with the Blues settlement.
Yeah.
In Mississippi. Boy, that sounds like that could be a family industry.
Yeah, you know, just I'm just concerned about the selling off of the property. So I'm going to talk with Ann Booth Buffington, because she would know who to connect with. Yeah, as far as who's handling that, because they have the organizers of the reunion would know as well, because once again, we used to have a reunion. We would alternate different cities. So those that were actually in charge of reunions would set up the charter to host, because I just learned as I got older there were way more boozes than I knew about, because my dad kind of was.
Well, let me ask you this now. If you were to take a guess, how many boozes or family members are there?
Oh, wow. Because it was a rare name when I was growing up. I'm 53. So looking at, you know, what I see on Facebook and the great-grandchildren and my great third and fourth cousins, boozes, I would at least say, although my name is not really rare to me now, but I would say that there's at least 3,000 to 4,000 of us. Because, you know, I guess I would be ones that are married into the family, but the core family, I'm just guessing, about 3,000.
Now, how many are, all right, so 3,000 course. Now, how many of those would you say would be 21 years of age and older?
Oh, that's interesting.
About 1,000?
So we have a lot of little cousins. 21 and older, I could not honestly take that guess.
Well, let's say 1,000.
Because I'm just looking from Facebook. Yeah. I could say that. Yeah. I could say 1,000, 1,500.
1,000. So I'm looking at it as that's 1,000 households. And let's say you got 1,000 households within the Booth bloodline here. And let's say just on average, and I'm lowballing here, very lowballing, that they had a household income of only $10,000 a year, which I'm sure is more than that, but I'm just extremely lowballing. So 1,000 times $10,000 a year, that's $10 million that bare minimum that's in that Blues family. You can do a whole lot of 10 million.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like I said, look, you got to figure, you know, that a single person needs more than $10,000, you know, on average household income. So I'm just looking at, you know, just 1,000 people, you know, that took away the other 2,000. And the next time you go to, I mean, there's a lot, even within your own household, you know, it's, now, let's look at this another way where, okay, let's say you got 1,000 members there in the Boost family. Now, that's based on a paycheck income of just $10,000 a year. Now, let's say they all have houses, and let's just put the houses at 25,000. Wait a minute. Okay, 1,000 with they're living in a $25,000 house. Oh, excuse me, I did that wrong.
$25,000, not $25,000. I'd like to, if you could help with something. I'm on my podcast, so we could just talk about the settlement. So, just wanted to mind sharing a couple of things about the settlement and our families. Okay, so I want to check the number to call in for this phone. Okay, I'll do that. And let her know it's Reba. Thanks. Hello, Brother L.A.?
Yeah.
I do apologize.
Yeah,
I was able to reach my cousin, Ann. She's with her caregiver. She's like 90. She's 90 years old or something. So her caregiver is going to have her to call in to the number. So I apologize.
Right, well,
I can't
get
back
to
my phone. This phone. This phone that we're talking on, it's the storage is super low, so I couldn't even get back to my. That's why when I pick up, it's slow to move to get to where I can unmute it. So
you probably need to delete some of the apps on it if you got a lot of apps on it, because apps take a lot of space.
Well, it's the pictures for me. I deleted some apps because got family pictures. It's the pictures and movies. I got a new grandma too, so that didn't.
What I did to get rid of a lot of pictures on my phone, load them up to Pinterest. Load them up to Pinterest, and you got it online in the cloud. So you still had the pictures, but, you know, you can, like, see, that's what I did. I had, like, over 11,000 pictures on my phone over the years, and I just started, I still haven't sorted them out on Pinterest, but. That's what I do. I put them up on Pinterest, which is free. Now, I'm waiting for, Reba, you got a calculator on your phone or near you?
Pardon me?
Yeah, you got a calculator you got access to on your phone?
I do.
All right. Multiply 1,000 family members, 1,000 Boosts, blood relatives, and let's say each one of them lives in a house that's what would you say the average price of a house in Chicago is?
Pardon me? What would I say?
What would you say the average price of a house is in Chicago?
In Chicago? It depends on the area. Let me see. Average price. My house was price. Okay, my house, my little California ranch was valued at $160.
Okay, all right, hold on. All right, let's go with that figure. Okay, so we got 1,000 Booses times, you said 150,000?
160.
All right, let's go with 100,000. So let's say you got 1,000 Booses and they live on average in a $100,000 house. Okay, so 1,000 times 100,000. The Booses have are worth at least $100 million. That's just one family. That's not even including everybody.
Right.
That's the way about family mathematics. That's what we'll call it.
Okay.
Matter of fact, you know what? That's going to be a
family economics.
Family economics and family mathematics. You know, and you can, and that's just one. You know what? And that you really don't need it. Just start at home. Start at home with your own little family, and then grow from there. Okay, let me see. I'm going back to see if they called in. Now, of course, in some cases, maybe in many cases, you might have to, if you can't get your family to go along with it, I mean like at a reunion or something like that, then you just got to do your own, start your own thing within your own household.
Mm-hmm.
Which, that's what I'm doing. All right, they haven't called in. But the thing is about this board, they could be. All right, 619-768-2945. If you are listening in, just press 1, and then we can see you on the board, because sometimes we can see you, and then if you haven't pressed it, half the time we can see you, and other half the time we can't. All right, well, give us some background on the person that might be calling in. Okay, Reed was somewhere. Anyway, next week, matter of fact, let me write this down now, put it in my notes, family mathematics. Family mathematics, this is going to be a podcast series. Wait a minute. Family mathematics. A podcast series. I can imagine that can be challenging, though, because how do you organize something like that? All right, I'm waiting for my phone. Okay. All right, Reba, you there? Okay, I think she dropped off. And she's got stories for you. So while we're waiting for her to call back in, all right, well, let's take this musical interlude till they call back in. To the phone lines, like I said, next week, probably starting Monday, we're going to do somewhere a series, at least one show next week, Family Mathematics, because if some of our families would sit down and just do just a little arithmetic, no algebra, no geometry, do a little bit of arithmetic, we're sitting on millions. I just know my mother's side of the family. Man, there's 88 acres. We can all be set. Man, you know what you can do with 88 acres? But anyway, however, in some cases, you got to do your own thing, and then maybe people jump on the bandwagon. Anyway, let's go back to Reba. Reba, your mic is open.
Okay, great. So my cousin Ann is on the line, and she is 88 years young. So can you hear us, Ann?
Yes,
okay. Okay, wow. So Brother L.A. is the host of DIY Do-It-Yourself TV podcast, and Reba Media is what we came up with, so we can share information about our Black communities and the legacy.
Okay.
And so you can share, if you don't mind, some about the legacy of the Booth settlement.
Right. Okay, whatever questions he has to ask, I try and
well, you know,
to answer the best I can because I'm not the oldest, but I know a lot about the Blues family. Yes.
Well, thank you for coming on. Well, let's start off with the first question is, how many acres is the Booth settlement?
How many acres is it?
Yeah.
It's quite, I never thought about the acreage. I just thought about the space. It's, it got to be a few hundred acres, okay, because they're
you,
all
you
over, but as they...
You said 300 acres?
I'm going to guess at it. I'm not sure.
Okay,
because there's
acres.
A lot of booze in... Hello?
Mm-hmm.
Are you listening to
yeah,
what
I'm
talking about?
No. Yeah. I'm listening.
Okay. As I listen, my dad, he's the booze in the family. Okay. His father owned... Matter of fact, we still have people living there because when I was in a nursing home for a while, and it was in that area. And I met a son that came to visit me while I was in the nursing home. And it has to be at least 300 acres or more, because and there's a lot still there, and some of them are gone and moved into other states and things like that, and sold out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about as best I can get because I'm not the oldest one on that side of the family.
Okay.
But my dad, now he's been passed a long time. Because he and my mom, they had 13 children, okay? And they all stayed down in Mississippi until everybody started moving north and east and wherever else. Mm-hmm. So is there anything else wanted to...
Well, yeah, yes. I mean, that's very impressive. 300 acres, and that's all in Mississippi, I believe.
Oh, that's all in what we call Hickory, Mississippi.
Hickory, Mississippi.
Right.
Now, early on, like when you were a little girl, did your family members, did they build their own houses?
Oh, yeah. Built their own house. They built the school. They built the church. There's a cemetery that's still there. It, everything was there.
Ooh, boy, that's impressive. Reba, you got any questions to ask?
Well, I'm going to visit sometime soon because I was just sharing with Ann that I'm a new grandma. And, you know, just the photos, the pictures, the vintage photos of our family, Henry Booth, and great-grandfather. I was taking notes, so I want to actually see if we can get Susan as well, Susan Booth. She's in New York.
Okay.
So just kind of figure out. I just connected with Ancestry.com, and then my brother, Zanzel, his son told me that his youngest son just told me that he registered with Ancestry.com and he's learning more about the Booth family.
Okay.
So that's exciting. So I certainly want to see if we could just get together so everybody can meet you. Yes. And a reunion. Are we going to have you heard talks of a reunion sometime soon?
There is. No, it's going to be in Michigan.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to come because, like I say, with my walking chair and my walking and my wheelchair and my walker,
uh-huh.
I'm not even comfortable going out to any place that I have to do a lot of walking and stuff.
Okay.
My granddaughter just graduated from high school. I didn't go because of that reason.
Okay. Well,
because,
congratulations on your grad.
Mm-hmm.
We'll certainly make sure that we have everything virtual and streamlined.
Oh, great. Okay.
Well, how do you say that?
Live stream.
We can see the video, a live video, and then you can speak as well. I'll make sure that I connect with the family to make sure we have that set up, too.
Okay. Have you gotten anything about the Booth reunion for this year? Because the year before we had it, and I was all set up to go, but the virus came.
Yeah.
And when the virus came, that knocked me out. because I knew that hotel probably wouldn't accommodate us with that virus.
Yeah.
So that when at that time I was able to go.
Right. Yeah. Well, speedy healing to you, because you're a go-getter. I was certainly, I know that much about you. That spirit, it runs in our family, that go-getter spirit.
Yes.
So I know you're with your caregiver now, and she's, you probably have therapy, physical therapy with her or someone else, right? Do you get physical therapy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Physical therapy. Mm-hmm. I've been in that for quite
mm-hmm.
a while.
Okay.
In different locations.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, she was really nice, and I tell her thanks. I appreciate her connecting the call, you know, letting you know that I was calling.
Okay.
And the other thing is that so we have two new boozes from my children, and
okay.
the father's name is Bernard. This is a Bernard that I was,
Bernard.
You know, I let him know.
I have a Bernard brother, Bernard.
I told him that. I said, you got a great cousin, Bernard.
Yes.
And then his sons are Bhavani James Booth and
okay.
Elijah Zaire Booth. Mom named him Eli Zaire. I'm
okay.
saying Elijah Zaire. 4 months, 5 months, and
okay.
Bhavani is 22 months.
Oh, they're very new.
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome to the Booth family, and hope they keep it going.
Thank
you know, going
you.
On because
that's right.
You know, if the younger folks don't keep it going on, you know, it'll die.
Right. But there are a lot of Brother LA asked how many boozes that I would perceive that we have in our family. But of course, with Facebook, I'm looking like it's hard to. Because I'm like, there's cousins and little cousins, and
right.
I even connected with a booze, and we found out that we're related. And then I taught a booze. His last name, he has his dad's last name, but his mother is a booze, Cassandra
okay.
booze. So he was in my family.
Cassandra sounds familiar.
Right. So we just got to connect. And then when they came out, I met some other boozes.
Okay.
You know?
Because we all started from... Zach was my grandfather.
Zach Booth.
Zach, right. Zach and his wife was Sunny. And they raised their kids up in the Booth settlement, like their other brothers and sisters, too, that was there. Now, just look at the family tree. The first one we had, we really had a lot of names on there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But
wow.
Because my dad had 13 of us.
Okay.
So if you look at the rest of the family, he's just one out of a whole bunch of
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of boozes. And some you meet today that you didn't know was out there, but they are.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
So I look forward to seeing you soon. I'll give you a call offline.
Okay,
and
thank you.
I can get together.
And okay, do you have the information for the reunion that's going to be in Michigan?
I'm going to reach out if you are limited what you have, or if you have something to share, I will certainly be there because I started a travel agency, and this is the perfect time. The God's divine order.
Uh-huh.
And so I just flew to – my brother got married, so he brought a young lady into the family. Her name was Crystal.
Okay.
So my brother got married last Friday.
Oh,
and,
okay.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So I will certainly – look forward to it. So if you have limited information, but
I've got the information
probably...
for it because it's in Michigan near where a lot of my brothers and sisters and cousins and your cousins and all the rest of them live.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's where they started from. It's, you know, up near Flint, Michigan.
Okay.
Well, I think everybody know where Flint, Michigan is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, I'll get that from you. I'll get the information.
Right.
I'm so excited. So what month is it going to be? Is it going to be?
It's right offhand. I'll have to pull it up on my computer because I know I wasn't going to be able to go this year because of my the arthritis and my limited mobility.
Okay.
So give me your, you got a new address of what I have on my record for you?
I actually do.
So give it to me. I'm going to write it down here. And I'll send you a copy of it.
Okay. So we're live on the air.
So I'm going to
call
you.
So you can call
back.
Me. Yeah.
Yes, I certainly will do that. I'm so excited. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Okay. Well, you're welcome. And thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay,
Reba.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Love you all, okay?
Love you, too.
Okay. All right. Okay, Reba, take care and have a good day.
You, too.
Yeah, okay.
Brother L.A.,
I got it. Okay. Reba, you there? Okay, wait a minute. All right, well, I'm glad Reba, she's been having some phone problems, but we're staying here. We're not going to go nowhere until she calls back in, and I'm trying to get back to my studio now. That, man, I renamed today's podcast. Today I just had trending topics. I just renamed this podcast today Boots, B-O-O-S-E, Boots Settlement Max. Okay. I'm going to see if I can get Reba to give me, if anybody out there who's listening, if you have an elderly, if you yourself or have a elderly relative that can share a story like Reba just did, she shared, you know, part of her family, contact me because we want to put that out there. What I'm about to say might be controversial to some. One of the reasons why, now this is just me personally, I'm not a fan of reparations is because of what we just heard. Here's a family, a black family, that they have a settlement. And a settlement, Houston, Texas is a settlement. New York City is a settlement. But it's a municipal settlement. But everything starts off as a plain old settlement. Then it goes to villages and towns and all these other legal descriptions. But the Booth settlement is really it's a village, 300 acres. There are municipalities in this country that are not even 300 acres big, not even 100 acres big. Some are not even 50 acres big. So here's a family that they have their own land, 300 acres, and thank God it's still in the family. And I appreciate them. I mean, they've kept it in the family. So if you work it like they've been working it, why do you need to go to the government? So kudos to this branch of the Booth family who've kept this in the family. And you know what? There's a lot of people listening that if you go up the family tree just a little bit, you'll find that, you know, there's something significant there as well. Maybe not with all families, but there's a lot more out there than people would suspect. But it all starts with one person and one household. So, all right, I'm trying to get back to my studio here. Wait a minute. Okay, B. All right. Man, it won't let me back in. Oh, Jesus. And now my cousin's calling me. Okay. I may have to call her back. Oh, man, this won't let me get back in the studio. All right, well, look. I'm going to try one more time. Okay, it's not letting me back in. So, look, what we're going to do, I hate to conclude the show like this, but difficulties. All right, anyway, look, we're going to pick back up on this on Monday. Man, I can't even I'm going to try one time to go to the studio. All right. Okay, people. Well, have a great weekend. Reba, if you can hear me, I'm going to give you a call. I'm going to call some other people. We're going to continue this out with the Booth settlement on Monday, first thing. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day and have a great weekend.